Welcome to the Design Thinker podcast, where we explore the theory and practice of design.
Hosted by me, Donnie, and
me, Peter.
Welcome, everyone. You're listening to the Design Thinker podcast, season 2, episode 2. So what are we talking about this week, Peter?
This week, Donnie, we are talking about visual communication when words fail us. So what is visual communication, or what does it mean to me? First thing that comes into my mind, and it literally does, so my mind does work in pictures, which I think explains why sometimes my patterns of speech are slow, because listeners might be used to it by now, and if you're still listening, you're probably enjoying it. If you don't like it, maybe you don't listen anymore. But the reason I think that my pattern of speech is a little bit slow sometimes is because pictures are forming in my mind, and then I translate them into words. Going off on a Billy Connolly style tangent already this early on, but I recently discovered that if we think of that as your mind's eye, some people don't actually have that. Their mind doesn't form pictures internally, which is really interesting. Maybe we'll come back to that as our Google moment to understand more about that. But what does visual communication mean? In really simple terms, it means showing each other pictures to increase our level of understanding. I'm gonna stop there.
Okay.
And keep it, unusually for me, keep it like a nice, short and simple description. But I will add on that I did look up the history, the etymology of these words. Like, where do they come from? Where does visual come from? Where does communication come from? Because I think we're starting to realize, Danny, that we like to know the roots of words, and sometimes it can help focus our conversation and our exploration. That gives us a bit of an anchor. So what I discovered is that visual, well, it can be an adjective or a noun, and visual it means relating to seeing or sight. If it's a noun, then it can mean a picture, a piece of film or display used to illustrate or accompany something. Now, apparently that visual, the noun, only started emerging in the English language in the 50s, which is pretty interesting in itself. But back to the adjective, which I think is the context we're using it in. So relating to seeing or sight actually comes from the Latin videre, to see. So it's one of these words that's pretty simple. There's no kind of hidden meaning to it. And then communication, it's the imparting or exchanging of information by speaking, writing, or using some other medium, which is what we're going to talk about today. And again, that comes from Latin, communicare, to share. So an adjective and a verb. And they haven't really changed much since good old Romans came up with them.
It's pretty. Thank you for looking that up. I liked how simple and straightforward visual was. It's what it says on the can, kind of thing. I guess for me, visual communication is that process of taking very abstract things out of our brain and creating something visual with it that we can share with others. And I think, so what I found when I was doing my research is that our ability to communicate visually predates our ability to communicate with words, or with written or oral words, right? And that's consistent, in us as individuals, and it's also consistent within our species as a whole. So if you kind of look back to, we've discovered cave drawings and things like that. So we know that early humans communicated with each other through drawings. But on a more individual level, we know that we have the ability to create visuals way before we have words. And the best test of that is, you know, you put a crayon in a three-year-old's hand and they will just naturally start making things. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, you've got no clue what they're making, but you know, the action of creating something, it's happening, right? And that stays with them. And even as they're developing words, they're still drawing. Like, so you kind of go from drawing squiggly blobs of things to, you know, when this is a house, this is a flower, like you. So there's that association with our early communication being in a very visual format as well.
Keep going, or if you want, but I'm intrigued by this, what you just talked about, sparked some thoughts on my mind. As human beings, as a species, Homo sapiens, etc. So I guess pictures, the ability to communicate in pictures predates our ability to communicate in words. And whether those, here's an interesting question. Does it predate our ability to communicate vocally, or does it simply predate our ability to communicate in written words?
So I don't know, because I haven't really studied that element of our species history. My understanding is that early humans did have some verbal ways of communicating. It's not language as we understand it today, but I'm not really sure in terms of timeline. If we were drawing pictures before we were, we had any verbal ways of communicating. That point that I made is specific to us on an individual level, more so than a species.
So, so as individuals, modern day humans, you and I, everyone before us, everyone that will come after us, as children, we can communicate in pictures earlier than we can in either, you know, vocally expressed language or written language. Okay. And I think our kind of meanings, our definitions of what you mean by visual communication are fairly aligned. It's taking ideas out of our heads, making pictures of them, or I'm going to maybe suggest, and we could come on to this and how we do it, but either making or finding pictures, using pictures to communicate ideas. What about the second part of our kind of topic, when words fail us?
So when I was looking at this whole concept of visually communicating, when it came up as one of the core capabilities of design thinkers in my research, what I found is that you mentioned earlier that you see things in pictures. It's a very common way our brains process visual images at a much faster rate than it does language. And again, I think that goes back to our brains have been processing images for a lot longer than it has language as we know it. So it's just better at it. But I think the idea of like, why do we use pictures when words fail us comes from that. If we're seeing things visually in our brains, there's an extra step for us to take that visual and put it into language. Whereas if you could see it and you draw it, it's a quicker translation. So think about it like if you speak two languages, generally, if you're thinking about something, you would generally think about that thing in your dominant language. And then when you go to speak it, your brain has to translate what you thought in your first language to the second language before you can speak it. And I think with visual communications, it's a similar process.
Okay. So that means maybe we're kind of segueing nicely into why is visual communication and using visual communication as we just defined it, when words fail us, why is that important? You know, continuing with your language analogy, which I think is really helpful. So one of the reasons I think visual communication, well, I know visual communication is helpful because I see it happening over and over again, is doing the job of, you know, taking something out of my mind, putting it into a picture or drawing, and then it goes directly back into your mind. But if it was you drawing and then into my mind, then I'd be translating it into my own either language or perception, or using my own mental models without the filter, I guess, of your words, which is using your language, two different languages. You would take something in one language, translate it into another so I could understand it. Then I would read that, translate it back into another language so I could understand it.
That's a lot of cognitive load.
That's a lot. Even trying to work it out and talking about it, if anyone's still listening after that, well done. Yeah, exactly. So even that's just exemplifying what that is, a cognitive load. But we do that all the time, don't we? Like, I guess we're doing it right now because you and I are talking to each other and we're, you know, each using our mental models to take the idea, communicate it, and then listen to it, and then we kind of package it back into our own brains.
Yeah, I think something I want to clarify before we go too further in this is that when we talk about visual communications, I think in this context, when we talk about it, I think it's important to recognize that this is not about creating beautiful pictures. So this is not about, you know, this is not about being artistic in creating pictures. This is about, you know, very rudimentarily shapes, lines, you know, arrows, just very basic things to communicate an idea or to get an idea out of your head. And I think sometimes the reason we don't leverage this capability that we naturally have is that we get caught up in that pretty drawing lens.
Yeah, that's a nice clarification. Thank you for providing that. And it kind of gives me, if we define it as that, so Peter and Danny's season 2, episode 2, definition of visual communication is using pictures, share ideas. And our definition of pictures is non-artistic and you know, rudimentary marks that are not letters or words that are just enough. We talked about that in season 1, just enough to communicate an idea. So then for me, that another reason that definition is important is because everybody can do it. Like the 3-year-old can do it. You can do it. Anyone who can, use any kind of drawing implement can do it. Yeah. As I'm talking, I'm thinking, well, drawing implements everything from, a piece of charcoal on a piece of paper, you know, some sort of human computer interface that allows somebody who isn't able to, you know, grip a piece of charcoal and use a piece of paper for whatever reason, but they can communicate visually using that interface. So in other words, the reason what we're talking about and visual communication in this definition is so important is because there is no level of artistic talent required to communicate visually using our definition. And you know, our definition is the context of design thinking. Yeah.
When I did this research with people, what I found really interesting is people were doing this, but when we started describing it as visually communicating, people would go, oh, I don't do that. But then we had clear evidence of how in their problem solving process they were doing it. Mm-hmm. And so there's a bit of a disconnect, I think, whenever we use words like sketching or drawing, that it gets immediately associated with artists.
Yeah. Even the word design, actually.
Yes.
A lot of people's kind of, prior experience means that they shy away from that. even though they might be designing something, because they don't see it as designing, because they aren't creating a beautiful visual artifact of any kind, whether it's a sketch of a product or a really beautiful looking journey map or anything like that. So I'm liking this this definition, this clarity, and honing in on why it's important. Any other thoughts on why it's important?
Yeah, I think it might be good to kind of dive into, because I think sometimes we forget how something like this can be very practical in everyday situations, right? So maybe if we could share with our listeners an example, just a very practical example of when we use visual communications in our work.
Okay. So the one that's been going through my mind recently actually is mapping out a journey, so customer journey mapping, which is a way of communicating visually. And again, even the very first version, the very first iteration of a customer journey map, which, you know, when I do it or help people do it, is very rudimentary. It's really rough and ready. It's got the bare amount of information in it. You know, if there's a picture of a person in it, then it's literally a stick person rather than some elaborate sketch or even, you know, comic book cartoon type figure. Yeah, using that journey, I guess it's to the fore, because I'll give an example of where I'm not seeing it at the moment and it could be helpful. So, and I can't give you too much detail because it's a project that hasn't emerged into kind of reality yet. But let's say an experience that customers are having is being designed, and the experience involves, or might involve at the end, the customers interacting with an app on a mobile device, a mobile phone, and they might be using that before they go into a store, or during or even after. At the moment, what I've not seen is a kind of illustration, a drawing, a picture, or that describes or shows when a customer might be interacting with this mobile device. Now, that's not to say that people haven't thought about it and there isn't a really well-defined idea of when that's going to happen, but drawing a picture of that is going to be really helpful for everybody involved in this particular design of a customer experience, to understand what the intent is and also what the opportunity is and who might need to be involved in order to shorten things down. Seeing a picture of a customer journey, where, you know, which might be a scene-by-scene comic book story of a customer before they go into a store, to what they do in store when they come out of store, can really bring to life what that experience is. I got interested in this quite a long time ago, actually, and read some books on comics and people who made comics, comic book artists. When we do show notes for our episodes, Danny, I will put the comic book, those books in the show notes. What they explained was actually some of the science behind the psychology, I suppose, behind comics, is if you draw the characters in the comic with just enough detail, then the reader can imagine themselves as that character. But I know we're going into how we do this, but too little detail and people can't quite imagine themselves. Likewise, too much detail, and again, they can't imagine themselves. But I think, using journey mapping as an example, if we can do it with just enough detail to begin with, that people can imagine themselves in the shoes of the person in the story or in the journey, then we can help everybody involved in designing the experience ask the right questions to find the right answers to ultimately designing the best experience that meets the intent that we set off with.
So I think that's a really good example. I want to add on to the comic book piece that you said. So I think it was in 2015, there was a dissertation that was published in comic book.
Dissertation in comic book, okay.
Like the whole, so dissertation is what, you know, a PhD student publishes their, you know, it's like their research. And there was one where the whole format of the dissertation was done in a comic book style.
Oh, okay.
And there's a lot of, I haven't personally seen it, but the commentary around that is really around the power of how much words can say. Because if you think about something so complicated and so detailed and nuanced as a dissertation, and the idea that you can actually do that all in visuals is quite intriguing. Again, I haven't seen the actual dissertation, but this was kind of the discourse that was around it.
That kind of shows the power of, because, you know, of simple drawings. Yeah. Maybe on a similar side note, I think you can probably still find it. When Google originally released Chrome, you know, the web browser that's been around for a long time, they released a comic book, a PDF comic book, I've got it somewhere, that described, you know, what Chrome was and how it was built and what it did and why it was different to other browsers, because in those days it was really different to other browsers, but in a really kind of technical level that most people wouldn't care about, but Google felt people should at least kind of care about and understand. So I thought that was a really genius way of communicating a complex technical issue, but making it pretty human. It was a great. Have you seen that? Have you seen that Google comic?
I haven't, so I'd be keen to see it if you could dig it up.
Yeah, I'll dig it up and share it with you.
Thanks. Just a couple of more examples of where visuals have helped, right? So for me, like when I am doing, if I've got to pull together like a PowerPoint presentation or something, I'll usually just kind of sketch it out on post-it notes at a very high level, like this is what it should look like kind of thing. Because then I can, you know, get my ideas down quickly. I mean, it's very ugly. And if you were to see it, you'd go, what the heck is that? So that's one way that I use that. When I'm looking at planning something like, you know, if I'm pulling together like a lesson plan, or even when we're planning our podcast episodes, like I always sketch those out. Like, you know, I have a square for the intro, you know, square for the middle, and I use it. Like I kind of document what we're going to say. I use like big words, like meaning I write the words out big, but it's usually in a very flowy, drawn out way, rather than kind of bullet pointing it down, because that just doesn't, my brain doesn't process that very well. Yeah.
Yes, same. I mean, I suppose we're getting into that kind of intersection of words and pictures, or visual and words. Most of my notes are some sort of mind map. Again, it kind of comes back to why is it important. Our brains are kind of association-making machines, for want of a better word. So our brains are always looking for links between things, and it's easier to make links using both words and pictures. So words alone are rarely powerful enough. Coming back to the comic books, and maybe this is again is kind of going backwards and forward, which is cool. From why is it important to how do we do it? But going back to the comic book examples we talked about there, and your original definition, which I really like, which is rudimentary marks, like communicate visuals. When we're talking visuals here, we're talking about nothing more than lines. Obviously, comic books are a bit more advanced than that. So I don't know. Can you talk to us about, you know, what are those rudimentary marks? What is the equivalent? What are the building blocks of a visual language that people can use and that you use to just get going?
Yeah, I think if I were to relate it to something that we're probably familiar with, I would think that the starting point of visual communication is just using very rudimentary things like lines and shapes, right? Things that we all know how to draw, and things that if we, you know, if you drew it and I saw it, no matter how bad you think you are as a drawer, chances are you can draw, you know, you could pull four lines together and make a square. It might not be perfectly straight. So that's kind of like your entry level of visual communication. And then in that, you can use a few words. Like you said, our brains make very little associations with things. So you can use some words within your visuals, right? Then I think if you wanted to move beyond just that entry level of visual communication, you might look at, you know, how do I combine shapes to make other pictorial things? So I can draw a circle and attach it to, you know, and attach a little triangle to the side and draw an oval, and that makes a bird. So that's kind of maybe your level two of visual communication, right? Yep. And then you can get quite fancy with it, like a comic book, or, you know, getting better at with your drawing skills so that you are drawing like full-on people or characters or whatever. And that, you know, we could think about as a very advanced way. And all of us sit somewhere on that scale. And I think the point is, we don't all have to be in that advanced level. I don't think it's necessary for the type of work that most of us do and for what we need to use visual communication for. I don't think it's necessary for us to be at that advanced level. I think if we're all at level one, or, you know, if level one rather is as far as we can get with it, it's still very beneficial and productive.
I agree with that. I think it would be imagining a world where, you know, we see as many pictures as words in our, let's say, our work communication. We're quite far away from that world, and I'm wondering why, and also maybe related to our, you know, how do we do it question, like, well, how might we draw more, like, you know, and maybe it starts with you and I, like, how do you habitually draw something, or do you have to say to yourself, right, I'm going to draw this?
Actually, I want to just correct something, or okay, put in another view of something.
Please.
You said that we were far away from, yeah, in a world where visual communication is, yeah, is a common thing. Mm-hmm. I actually think it's more about us getting back to, right? Like, if you think about your child self or a kid that you know, like, they're always drawing and scribbling and doodling, and somewhere along the way, we stopped doing that in favor of written language and spoken language. So I think it's more about getting back to something, which to me is quite exciting, because it's not something new that we're learning. It's actually something we already know how to do, and it's more about remembering that we know how to do it.
Yeah Okay, well, that actually resonates really strongly with me. I'll kind of, maybe I'll answer my own question in that. No, I want you to answer it. Stop playing tricks on me. do you, what's going on in your brain in the moments before you start drawing something?
What's going on in my brain before so I am a visual thinker. Mm-hmm. And for me, I see something before I can formulate words to it. Mm-hmm. So usually, it's when my brain does that thing, like, where it's like, you know, those old cars when the engine wants to start and you turn the key and it sounds like it's going to start and then it just stalls. That's what's happening in my brain right before I start drawing.
I'm just imagining that noise. Yeah, I can relate to that. And are you making a conscious choice between pictures or words coming out of your brain and going onto paper or digital equivalent?
I think it's a kind of a mixed bag of things, right? Because sometimes I might just draw a shape, mm-hmm. and then I might draw a word, and then I might go, okay, something here is going to connect to something here, and then mm-hmm. it's going to look like this. Mm-hmm. In my process, I move very fluidly between words and pictures. In saying that, though, it should really be word. Like, I'm not writing paragraphs of things, right? It's literally a word. But I also don't write it like I would, you know, I kind of draw the word like it's, mm-hmm. you know, not writing it like I normally would when I take notes. Here, and our listeners can't see, but I've kind of written out today's topic.
Yeah.
And you know, those lines kind of help me remember all the, like, these are kind of some of the things that I want to cover.
Yeah. For listeners, Danny's visual and communication work were kind of great big letters rather than just normal writing. I guess I'm asking you the question because, you know, I think a hypothesis I have based on probably my experience is that going back to what you said about, you know, drawing is within us and it's the first way we learn to kind of communicate. Even that there's a lot of unlearning to be done, and I find myself starting to write something and then going, hang on a minute, I'd rather be drawing, or my mind's telling me to draw something instead. So I stop writing it and revert to, or go on to, you know, drawing a picture. And even if the person I'm communicating visually with is myself, and I guess I'm based on my experience, I imagine that there's a reasonable portion of people listening or not listening out there who maybe continue writing when perhaps they might benefit from pausing with the writing and drawing instead. Whether, and I guess it's coming back to the importance, whether that's with themselves or even more importantly with other people. I guess I was just curious to know whether you had a kind of a brain kind of stop sign that's stopping yourself writing, and then as a simple step, you know, what's the first thing you can draw? And I go through it sometimes where, yeah, like I said, I kind of get writing something, pause, and then yeah, my approach is just to start using simple shapes like diagrams, arrows, circles, stick figures for people if I'm trying to illustrate a situation that people are involved in.
So the most basic thing that we can all do if we want to move, if you want to kind of have that stop sign, is like, I don't have notebooks with lines anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I don't buy them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's either kind of a blank notebook with no lines, or I think they call it the dotted mm-hmm. papers.
Yeah.
But basically I don't buy anything. I don't write on anything that has lines on it. And what I find it, because you have to remember, right? Our brains are very, our brains run on autopilot like 90% of the time. So, yeah, and for so many years, we've been taught to write between the lines. So it's almost like your brain sees those lines and it's like, oh, I know what to do here. So one very subtle thing we can do is actually just switch from lined paper to unlined, right?
Nice. I love that. That's beautiful. It's yeah, exactly. It's like I guess that's what I'm trying to get to. It's like I couldn't articulate in words. you've given us a perfect visual for it. Yeah, our brains have been conditioned through, you know, everything we've gone through to see lines on a piece of paper and start writing, take away the lines, and it opens up. Here's the opposite of Danny. So that creates a blank page. And we all know what a blank page can create.
Yeah.
What do you do when you see your blank page? What's the first step to putting something on it for you?
So one of the things I noticed when I write on blank pages is I always start writing in the middle of the page. And this is And I think so. Tony Besson's work on mind mapping, you know, if you're interested in this topic, Google it. Mind mapping is very closely mimics to how our brain works in terms of associations. So it's a very clever way to visually capture what's in your head or whether you're taking notes. So, if anybody's really interested in this, I would really recommend looking up Tony Besson's work on mind mapping, because it's a very easy way to go from our normal writing from left to right, top to bottom, to actually working in a way that's more in line with our brains. And switching to unlined paper kind of gives you the freedom to do that.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, I'm a big fan of mind mapping. And in fact, I would go as far as saying that somebody loaned me a copy of Tony Besson's book, The Mind Map Book, a long time ago, and it literally changed my life. So yeah, highly recommend it for anyone that sounds interesting too. Yeah, I do the same thing. I kind of start in the middle of the page and start reading it. And and some people call these brain hacks, don't they? So taking away lines, leaving yourself with a blank paper, putting something on the paper. Some people say just put a dot in the paper and that's you started. An alternative to that, if you're trying to warm up, warm up the visual part of your brain, is it's a great exercise. I can't remember whether it's from the D School or IDEO. Likely, somebody before that came up with it. But you can make this yourself. You get, go on the computer, get a blank PowerPoint or Keynote slide or, Miro frame, anything like that, and then put a grid of circles, and might get 30 or 40 empty circles on your blank page, and print it out or start using it digitally, and set yourself the and maybe your friends as well, the challenge of drawing as many things as you can in those circles, in the space of a minute or a couple of minutes, kind of forces you to start drawing, but gives you a little bit of something to draw within. So, you could draw a bunch of planets or circles or smiley faces, et cetera, et cetera. But it just gets your, I believe from my experience, it starts your mind going from words and literally into pictures. I find that as a good warm-up exercise that you can repeat. And if you've done it a few times, it's a good challenge to go, well, I'm going to try and come up with 30 new things instead of 30 things to say. Yeah, nice. I've got a question for you, again, about how we do this. Hopefully not too random, but what do you think of the idea of photographs as visual communication, and simply using photographs as visual communication? And I'll give you the example, a picture of a situation that a customer is involved in. And instead of sketching out, just taking a photograph and sharing it with a team and using that as the start of a discussion, and taking it one step further, having that shared online in something like Miro or Mural, and having everybody be able to kind of annotate that picture, whether it's in notes or questions or observations.
I think in that context, it's very appropriate. When we think about visual can come in so many different formats, right? It's what we draw. It's, we could use devices to capture what we're seeing. So modes of visual communication. In my research, it had a very specific meaning, which was, what role did visual communication play in problem solving? So when people were in the process of problem solving, what role did visual communications play? In that context, people mainly used diagramming as the mode, because that's what helped them either communicate the problem to somebody else or get someone else to understand the idea that they were trying to formulate. So in that context, this whole idea of drawing and sketching and diagramming is what emerged. Yeah. But I think in the context you were describing, a photograph is appropriate, you know, assuming that people know that they've been photographed, or, you know, making sure that all those privacy things aren't being violated.
Got you. Interesting. I had similar thoughts, but I also, I guess I'm curious about, is taking a photograph of something perhaps an unhelpful or partly unhelpful shortcut? Is it missing out that starting to build that hand eye and therefore brain eye and externalizing our own thoughts before taking a photograph of something?
No, I think this comes back to context, right? Because I think in ideation, or to spark ideation, to build empathy, photographs can be very effective, right? I think it was a Stanford workshop where he shows this picture of the girl reaching for the book.
Oh, yeah.
And if you just think about that, you see this picture of a girl trying to reach a book on a bookshelf and she's stretching and can't reach it. That explains a problem in a way that words may not. And it's a real person. So, you know, it helps build empathy. So I think there's a place for it. I don't think it's a shortcut. So, yeah, I think my take on that is there's a place for it.
And maybe that's nice to hear. Thanks for using those examples. I wonder if maybe for people who's maybe less naturally inclined to, you know, draw pictures, or their minds are less visual than sounds like ours are, then maybe a good place to start is with, you know, photographs or existing drawings, and kind of combining photographs and drawings are out there into their own picture.
I mean, start experimenting, right? Like spend more time in visuals and like see how you could bring visuals into your work. Just start experimenting with it and see what comes up. See how, you know, when you start, just play around with when you start introducing more images into your work, what's changing? How, you know, like be mindful of that too.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, like pay attention to maybe how your thoughts or ideas change or are slightly different. If you're focusing on pictures rather than on words.
And, you know, like for our listeners who are maybe in the corporate world, one very easy way you can start playing around with this is, and we know all organizations are like, you know, death by PowerPoint. how might you use visuals to make those PowerPoints, you know, more interesting? And that's an easy place to start, right? Because it's something you're doing. And rather than, you know, over flooding those slides with words and bullet points, challenge yourself to like make a PowerPoint without any bullet points.
I'm building on that. And I guess my question on, and I liked your counter to my kind of point of view that maybe we're not visual enough, and you're suggesting actually we can just go back to being more visual. I think part of it is to do with the tools. So imagine a version of Outlook, or maybe you could switch Outlook from words to pictures on a Friday or something, and instead of you weren't able to type, you had to draw, and everyone had to email each other using pictures of some sort, or vision, you know, lines and shapes rather than words. That would be interesting to see what emerged out of that. Just that kind of having to do it rather than choosing to do it. It's kind of interrupting the defaults.
Like rather, you know, when somebody messages you how you are, sending back an emoji kind of thing. There's also that exercise about, you know, telling your life story in 15 emojis. Have you done that one before?
No. Well, that sounds interesting. Okay.
That's an interesting one to do.
Sounds like a good fun warm-up.
Yeah.
15 emojis.
I think it gets harder every year it passes by. So let's see. We've talked about what visual communication is. We've talked about why it's important. We've talked about some ways for you to start you know, on this journey. And then we've kind of talked about some practical examples of where this shows up. So what does it all mean?
So for me, it all means, I think it's something we should put more effort into. Yeah, put more effort into, because it's kind of, it's taking the filters off both directions and both sending a message out and receiving it in as individuals. And then if you multiply that in a group, then it's only going to be beneficial. I think it's almost an underused but essential way of communicating, that if we start building as a muscle and strengthen as individuals, then I guess we'll collectively be better. What about you?
What it all means for me, and this is really informed by my research, is that we actually engage in visual communication more than we think we do. And so I always think about, if we could be more mindful about it and use it more, what might the impact of that be, and what might the collective impact of that be? Because I've seen examples of, like almost every single profession, from engineers to doctors to surgeons, in their work, they use visual communication in some form. And they're almost not aware of it, right? So if we were to increase that awareness, and we all kind of leaned into the fact that, hey, this is something I can do, what might that impact be? So that's kind of where my so what about this sits.
Nice. And then key takeaways.
I think for me, this has been a good reminder of kind of getting back to, sketching, or getting back into a ritual about practicing what I preach more, and kind of implementing some sort of, I used to do this thing where, draw a picture every day kind of thing, and you start at the beginning of the alphabet and try to make your way all the way to the end of the alphabet.
Yeah.
So like an image per letter.
Yeah. Nice. Funnily enough, I'm thinking, really along similar lines for the takeaway for me. It's a reminder to almost go back to basics and rebuild the drawing habit. And the fact, maybe, that I hope the fact that, the two of us have come up with the same thing helps people who are listening to this who go, hopefully some people go, I can draw a line on a circle and a square, but I'd like to do more of it. Well, you and I are kind of in the same boat, and we do quite a lot of it. So don't get ready, get started, everybody.
Get started and see where you end up.
Yeah, nice.
All right, I think that does it for us this time.
It does.
Thanks everyone for listening.
I'm going away to write my life story in 15 emojis.
Nice. Bye, Pete.
Bye, bye everyone.